This program contains explicit content and subject matter which may be unsuitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised.
Sex Out Loud is sponsored by Lilo, award-winning designers of the world's best pleasure objects.
Smart. Sexy. Kinky. Fun.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud with your host, sex educator, author, and filmmaker, Tristan Taramino. It's sex-positive radio like you've never heard before. Tristan talks about sexuality from every angle with leading authors, experts, artists, and icons. From sex education and sexual politics to BDSM and non-monogamy, nothing is off limits. So get ready to open your mind and expand your horizons. This is Sex Out Loud. And now here's your host, Tristan Taramino.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. And happy National Donut Day. Did you know that today is National Donut Day? Well, it is. And I, along with the masses, went and waited on a very long line at my favorite donut place called Donut Friend and got some of the most amazing gluten-free vegan donuts you will ever put in your mouth. And I get to enjoy those after my show. So last fall at Catalyst Con West, I did a series of interviews in front of a live studio audience, and you may have heard some of those. And one of the people I interviewed was Mireille Miller-Young. And we talked about her book, A Taste for Brown Sugar. There was a particularly fantastic audience who were super engaged and they had a ton of questions. And the conversation went in all these different directions, many of them unexpected, that were really deep and profound. And when I finished that interview, I remember saying to my partner, Colton, that is one of the best interviews I have ever done for the show. Hands down. And that is one of the richest conversations I've ever had in my life. And many people seem to agree, the people who were there. And so when we went back to edit the file, it turned out the audio file was corrupted. And we called on experts and tried a million and 10 million ways to resuscitate it. But in fact, it was lost forever. Which is just another reminder of the impermanence of our lives. And so for many, many, many months, I've been trying to get Mireille back on. And of course, we're both bummed that we don't get to have this in front of a studio audience because I think their input was really valuable. But we're going to try to not replicate, but have a conversation like the one we had way back when about her book. So let me tell you about her. Mireille Miller-Young, PhD, is Associate Professor of Feminist Studies at University of California, Santa Barbara. She researches and teaches about race, gender, and sexuality in U.S. history, popular and film cultures, and the sex industries. Her 2014 book, A Taste for Brown Sugar, Black Women in Pornography, was awarded the Sarah A. Whaley Prize by the National Women's Studies Association and the John Hope Franklin Prize for Book of the Year by the American Studies Association. A former UC President's postdoctoral fellow, Dr. Mireille Miller-Young was a co-convener of the Black Sexual Economies Project, a multi-year research scholar think tank at Washington University School of Law, and is a founder and convener of the New Sexualities Research Initiative at UC Santa Barbara. Along with Constance Penley, Celine Perenes-Shimizu, and me, she is the co-editor of the feminist porn book, The Politics of Producing Pleasure, which was a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award for Best LGBT Anthology. And I'm so happy to have her back on the show. Welcome back, Mireille.
Thanks, Tristan. I'm happy to be here. I love your show.
So this book, I mean, I want to make clear that it's incredibly significant that this book won the two awards that it won because it's about sex work and it's about pornography, and it is pretty unapologetically about both. And so winning these top prizes against books on, well, less controversial subjects is pretty incredible. So congrats on that.
Thank you so much.
And what strikes me about reading the book is it's just such an incredible piece of historical research and ethnography. I mean, you trace a history of Black women in pornography beginning in the 1920s. And there's sort of no stone unturned. I mean, it's so comprehensive. I mean, it has so much depth. Now, we can't start in the 1920s because then we'll be on the phone for like 5 hours. So I actually want to begin in the 1980s, which is much more recent, which sometimes is called the Silver Age of porn. And I want you to set the stage and the context for what was happening in porn at that time and how it specifically affected the production of all Black porn and so-called interracial porn.
Sure. You know, the 80s is, it seems really recent for people like us of a certain generation, but it's really far away for others. And at the same time, there's been like massive transformations in the porn industry. So it really is worth going back in time and thinking about porn in that moment, because it looks very different. You know, going into the 80s, you're coming out of what was known as the Golden Age of porn, which was an era when the United States Supreme Court had been debating pornography for a while. They finally kind of liberalized pornography after 73, saying that it was something that could be decided in terms of obscenity law by local politics, and that if it had any merit for artistic or scientific or educational purposes, that it was something that wouldn't necessarily be criminalized. And so pornographers had taken an opportunity to actually use that moment to bring pornography from out of the shadows and the underground into the mainstream. And many people remember that time as a time where, you know, was referred to as porno chic, the rise of very popular films like Deep Throat, which is one of the most successful, or at least high earning films based on how much it cost to make it, of all time. Even, you know, Jackie Kennedy was caught having, you know, coming out of a Deep Throat theater. It was so massively popular. And this kind of engine drove the industry as a film industry in which people went to the theater to watch porn. But what happens in the 80s is that the rise of this technology called VHS video, meant that people didn't necessarily need to go to the theater anymore. They could watch porn at home, in the privacy of their own homes. And this became really important for the production side of the industry, because it meant that you could make porn so much cheaper by filming direct to video as opposed to film. And it also meant that you needed less of a crew. You could do it faster. You could do it anywhere. It could be so much more mobile to produce pornography at that time. And what you saw is videos booming in terms of numbers, going from a few hundred in the 1970s to thousands in the 1980s, to 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 a year. And what this massive production meant for people who worked in the industry, including Black actors, is that there was a lot of opportunity to work, but the videos were so much more cheaply made. They stopped being like a real film set. The directors wanted to cut costs, and they had to also, the directors had to compete and find a market, because there were so many videos coming to market at the same time. And so they decided to, the directors and producers and the kind of industry experts started to try to really push particular kind of fetishes and genres of porn as a way to organize the industry. And they organized particular fetishes around race, particularly all Black cast and interracial porn. that, you know, builds off of the kind of porn that was produced earlier in the century, but, you know, became a really big market. And the goal of that market was to make a lot of money with very cheap product for largely white consumers, but also to try to grab, you know, people of color consumers, particularly urban viewers. And so you saw a lot of production around that time that, you know, was really tailored to trying to capture what white people thought of as black aesthetics. And a lot of it ended up being very problematic in terms of how it depicted race and gender at that time. And many of the actors who worked in that era were greatly frustrated by the kind of stereotypical images that they were asked to be involved with. And this isn't something new for porn or Hollywood, but people felt that it had intensified to a degree and that the industry was starting to get a bit grittier and a bit more degraded in terms of the imagination and the roles and the ways in which, you know, actors were being asked to portray them.
Okay, that's a great, you've set the stage for us. That is a great introduction. And also just noting that while it became cheaper to produce videos and it became easier for consumers to get them in the privacy of their own homes, still the major producers were white men, right? So it's not like it opened up this wave of opportunity for people of color behind the camera, right?
Absolutely. That we don't really see that until later, although a few people who were actors at the time, like Jack Baker, who was a very interesting actor, had come out of the blaxploitation, you know, movement. And as you know, in the end of the 70s, blaxploitation cinema, which had been this opening for black actors in Hollywood in this very kind of exploitative, degraded cinema, you know, closed. And you had all these actors who were looking for opportunity. And Jack Baker, you know, in some of his films, he wrote the scripts for Let Me Tell You About White Chicks, which was a Dark Brothers film. He, you know, basically inserted himself into a lot of the production in a way to try to have a voice and try to kind of have an influence on the creative process. And people like Angel Kelly, who was the first black actress to win a contract as a star, a paid contract from Perry Ross's Video at the time. And she's a major person in the book who I interviewed and was so excited to find after so many years of her having been retired from the industry and so many people remembering her fondly as a very beautiful woman, a very talented woman, and an interesting actress. You know, she did things like co-direct and try to insert her own point of view in many of the videos that she starred in as well. So while they did not kind of have control over these production companies or really get the opportunity to direct, I do argue in the book that it's important to notice the kind of interventions that actors did try to make at that time.
Okay, we've got to take a break. But I want to hear more about this. And of course, Angel Kelly, who's one of many former porn stars that you interview for the book. Let's take a break and hear from our great sponsors, including The Pleasure Chest and Lilo. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how black female performers were treated in the industry, various hierarchies, and we're going to talk about money, sex, and fame. So stay with us. More with Mireille Miller-Young when we come back. Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Listen, there is nothing sexier than experience. Just ask the Pleasure Chest. As the oldest sex-positive boutique in America, this legendary establishment has made it their mission to provide sexual fulfillment to everyone, regardless of orientation, identity, or experience. With stores in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, as well as online, The Pleasure Chest wants to help you have the best sex of your life. Whether you're buying your first vibrator or your 10th leather flogger, you'll be assisted by a knowledgeable and friendly staff in an elegant, sex-positive environment. If you're looking to expand your sexual expertise, they offer free weekly workshops in locations nationwide where no subject is taboo or off limits. Visit pleasurechest.com to learn more, because sex never goes out of style. You can use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free Pleasure Chest lube with every purchase.
Hi, everyone. It's Tristan. In a loving relationship, a pleasure shared is a pleasure doubled. Lilo, the world's leading pleasure brand, has a gorgeous selection of luxury pleasure products for couples, each one perfectly designed to ensure both partners get the most from sex. Lilo's remote-controlled pleasure products feature an exclusive technology called Sense Motion. You can control the vibrations of the massager by simply tilting and moving the remote. It's incredibly intimate, even from a distance. All Lilo's luxury couples toys are waterproof, rechargeable, quiet, and absolutely beautiful. Try the best-selling Tiani 24K for the most sensuous shared pleasure you've ever experienced, or the Lilo Smart Wand for the most powerful all-over body massage of your life. Go to Lilo.com or any good adult retailer now to see how Lilo can bring you closer together.
Ready to take your sex life to the next level? Let Tristan Taramino's award-winning Expert Guide Sex Education series help. Each DVD is packed with honest information, explicit techniques, scorching sex scenes, authentic chemistry, and real female orgasms. Go to puckerup.com and use coupon code SEXOUTLOUD for 25% off your order.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with Professor Mireille Miller-Young about her book, A Taste for Brown Sugar, Black Women in Pornography. Mireille, you touched on this before the break, but you really do track this sort of devaluation of Black performers, specifically Black female performers, and how they really were at the bottom of the hierarchy at every level of porn, from stereotypical portrayals in movies to how they were represented on box covers to their actual experience of the work itself and the inequity of pay that existed and, by the way, still exists for performers of color. And then alongside that, you talked to all of these performers, and I'm wondering if you could share with us like some of the feedback you got from them about what it was like to be a woman of color, one of the first women of color in the porn industry.
Mm-hmm. It was so powerful. You know, I was so lucky that I got to track down people like Angel Kelly and Jeannie Pepper. Jeannie Pepper's on the cover of my book. I'm looking at her right now. She was so gracious. They both were. And I think that for me, I was so moved by their stories, because there was such a sense of sadness and pain, because they went into the industry with all of this, you know, hope and desire to do something important for Black women and for themselves. They wanted to be the image that they wanted to see. They wanted to look at porn and be able to identify with, you know, all the pleasure that was going on screen. And to see another woman of color, a Black woman specifically, you know, enjoying her sexuality, taking control of her sexuality. And that's really what motivated them at that time to enter the industry. Of course, there were economic interests too, but not so much as you saw today, because really it wasn't so much of a such a better paying job at the time. It was more about the sexual rebellion and more about the kind of identity of, you know, playing with sexuality and doing something that was significant and countercultural. And what we see happen is that, you know, through the course of their careers, you know, Jeannie Pepper became really the first star. She entered slightly earlier than Angel Kelly, but Angel ended up being the one to get the contract and really got much more success because of that contract, you know, headlining movies, you know, the movies that have her name in it. Or that she's the lead star. But they noticed that both of them, no matter how, you know, big they got, they were always really second to white actresses, including even white actresses taking on bigger roles in movies in which they were supposed to be the star. And noticing that, you know, for Angel Kelly, that the contract that she had was paying much less than the white actress who was, you know, paid by the same company and other white actresses. And that, you know, that they were treated on set or had, you know, a set experience that reflected, you know, a much kind of lower quality and value to the films that they were in. Those were not the big mainstream feature films. They were kind of more for a niche market. And this kind of frustration with the inability to cross over into what was perceived of the mainstream of porn, where more opportunities and visibility and you know, economic success and mobility lie is a particular frustration. And I think that something that shines a light on that for Jeannie Pepper was the fact that she was able to mobilize her fame to travel abroad extensively. She married a German photographer by the name of John Dragon. He's a really interesting man and helped provide some of the wonderful images of Jeannie in the book from the 80s. I have color images in the book of her at the height of her career, which is really beautiful and powerful. And it's images of her all over Europe taking nudie pictures, you know, really daring pictures in front of, you know, the Eiffel Tower and at cafes and in Monaco and south of France and all these kind of places that she's wearing fur coats and really, you know, glamming it up. And she talks about the ways in which she felt very much at the time akin to someone like Josephine Baker, who had to leave the United States to feel, you know, respected and admired and adored. And it's a particular kind of fetishization that happens of Black people in Europe that feels very different for Black Americans. Like, a, you know, you're still fetishized, but it's a slightly less violent fetishism because, you know, the way in which that racism operates in Europe and their kind of colonial history is very different. And the point being that she felt that there were more opportunities there for her to be mobile, to be known, to be respected and seen. And coming back to the United States was very difficult. It's like, here we go again with the kind of entrenched racism in the business. And Angel Kelly had a very, you know, similar story and felt just very hamstrung by, you know, the business disrespecting Black women. And one of the kind of things that I talk about as a pivotal moment for her in the book was a film that she did called The Call Girl. It was directed by Herschel Savage, in which she plays a maid in a film that she's supposed to be the star. She's playing a maid to a white family who has to shuck and jive her way through the picture. Literally, she's quivering. She has a kerchief on her head. She's saying, you know, oh, look, playing the mammy role, basically, you know, oh, you know, I'm so sorry, you know, and playing up this kind of servile role. And it gets to be really interesting, though, because what she does is she negotiated with Savage and said, you know, it's not enough to play this role for this, you know, wealthy white family to be this servant. This character needs to have another life. And she forces him to make her into a part-time dancer who we see has this other life, who's not really at all this kind of mammy figure, but a really glamorous, beautiful, exotic dancer who's really pretty much lying to the family. And the reason why she's so hunched over and looks like she's in pain is because she's been having all this great sex. And, you know, she kind of adds that complexity to the character. At the time that this was happening, she started really noticing the way that she was being sidelined under her own company, Perry Ross, and in a lot of pictures, the refusal of people in the porn industry to really think in dynamic ways about, you know, the kind of possibilities that Black porn actresses can have and what kind of characters they can inhabit, and how we need to maybe challenge some of these like historical racialized fantasies that are really, really embedded in racism and white people's fantasy of who Black people are, like their servants or street prostitutes or all these kind of myths and stereotypes, and to give a bit more to be, you know, the sorority girl or the successful businesswoman or the teacher or some other kinds of even tropes that aren't so bound up with these kind of very narrow concepts of race. And it was very instructive to look at these two figures in the 80s and then see how everything that they want, this kind of more opportunity for glamour and for complexity, actually ends up getting worse for Black women during the 90s, with the rise of hip hop as being like the major trope to talk about Blackness and Black sexuality in America, and the porn industry basically investing in that and further kind of devaluing and diminishing Black women's roles by attaching it to a narrative of, you know, urban degraded street sexuality, the kind of the hoe image of this kind of urban ghetto girl that gets reproduced in the 90s is like even further narrow and degraded than the opportunities in the 80s. And it kind of goes on from there.
And that story you told is a great one to illustrate how you talk about Black women's strategies to work within and against stereotypical representations. So I want to pick that up, but we've got to take another break. Remember, folks, the Pleasure Chest always has free weekly classes at nearly all their locations in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York City. You can go to pleasurechest.com, click on locations, and find out what events are happening that week. They're all free. They're all taught by top-notch presenters. So go check that out. And when we come back, more with Mireille Miller-Young.
Hi, everyone. It's Tristan. In a loving relationship, a pleasure shared is a pleasure doubled. Lilo, the world's leading pleasure brand, has a gorgeous selection of luxury pleasure products for couples, each one perfectly designed to ensure both partners get the most from sex. Lilo's remote-controlled pleasure products feature an exclusive technology called Sense Motion. You can control the vibrations of the massager by simply tilting and moving the remote. It's incredibly intimate, even from a distance. All Lilo's luxury couples toys are waterproof, rechargeable, quiet, and absolutely beautiful. Try the best-selling Tiani 24K for the most sensuous shared pleasure you've ever experienced, or the Lilo Smart Wand for the most powerful all-over body massage of your life. Go to Lilo.com or any good adult retailer now to see how Lilo can bring you closer together.
Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Listen, there is nothing sexier than experience. Just ask the Pleasure Chest. As the oldest sex-positive boutique in America, this legendary establishment has made it their mission to provide sexual fulfillment to everyone, regardless of orientation, identity, or experience. With stores in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, as well as online, the Pleasure Chest wants to help you have the best sex of your life. Whether you're buying your first vibrator or your 10th leather flogger, you'll be assisted by a knowledgeable and friendly staff in an elegant, sex-positive environment. If you're looking to expand your sexual expertise, they offer free weekly workshops in locations nationwide where no subject is taboo or off-limits. Visit PleasureChest.com to learn more, because sex never goes out of style. You can use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free Pleasure Chest lube with every purchase.
No fluff, no lies, just real women talking real sex.
I am so bruised on my girl bits.
Sex gets real.
Sex gets so real.
So real up in here.
A weekly podcast with Dawn.
I just masturbated.
And Dylan.
Let's talk about the elusive clit.
Check them out on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and at sexgetsreal.com.
Cock rings.
Cock rings.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Yes, that is correct. You can email me with your questions and comments, but you can also call me. We have a 24-hour voicemail line where I would love to hear questions and comments, show ideas, advice questions, whatever you want. You can call 323-SEX-8266, 323-SEX-8266. And I'll remind you that I have a very busy summer planned. This is unusual for me, but it's true. You can go to my website, puckerup.com or tristantaramino.com, and click on tour and see all my events and get links about how to buy tickets, including June 25th. I'm going to be in San Diego for Poly Talks and Wry Relationships, talking all about open relationships. July 22nd, 23rd, I'm going to be in Dallas for Poly Dallas Millennium Presents, their second annual symposium, Designer Relationships. And August 4th, I'm going to be in DC doing my sex educator boot camps as pre-cons to Woodhull's Sexual Freedom Summit. And then, of course, I'll also be at Woodhull Sexual Freedom Summit also presenting. Special discount code for sex educator boot camp for listeners. You can use the code DEAL25 for 25% off your registration. So check that out. We've been talking with Mireille Miller-Young about her fantastic award-winning book on Black women in pornography. And we touched on this right before the break. I want to pick it right back up. Talking about, well, one of my favorite quotes in the book that you have is, "I suggest that porn work is part of a long battle for Black women to occupy their bodies," end quote. And so I want to talk about this term you use in the book, illicit eroticism, and the ways that Black women use it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. And I use this term, illicit eroticism. You know, it's a way for me to kind of create a theory about what I've learned from these women. Because the question I had going in to the research when I was a graduate student and I started my field work back in 2002 was, you know, given the, you know, overwhelming ways in which Black women are already so disparaged and assumed to be these hypersexual, very degraded figures, the ways in which our sexuality is always seen as being excessive and problematical. For instance, you can think of tropes that are often associated with Black women, like the welfare queen, who's seen as having too many children, and taking advantage of the state to support her, you know, hyperfertility, using the state's, you know, money. You can think of the kind of tropes around hip hop and the video vixen and the woman who shows too much of her body and uses her body in a too explicit, too sexual way. To even tropes about Black women as being unmarriable and just being someone that you kind of have sex with, but you don't marry or take seriously. These tropes have been circulating in culture for a long time, and they've, you know, evolved over time, thanks to different, you know, kind of policies and discourses and economic relations, and different ways in which racism and sexism have functioned. But they've pretty much, since slavery, have remained, you know, very much about Black women as being wrongly sexual, like not normally sexual. And one of the main myths that was created in slavery is that Black women wanted sex all the time. They demanded it from their masters. And that's why we cannot call what happened to them rape. I mean, that actually was something that was written about and spoken about at length at the time by you know, white people during during slavery to rationalize the institutionalized sexual violence against Black women, to create them as slaves that were available for concubinage, for breeding with other slaves, and for any kind of sexual access that anyone in a position of power wanted. And so it's a long history of seeing Black women in this way. And I wanted to know, given all that history, how do Black women enter porn? How do they function in porn? What does it mean to them? Do they have a sense that they are making representations and ideas about Black women worse? That they're, you know, they're adding to this negative image. How are they affected by it? And what I found was that these women are very aware of the stereotypes around hypersexuality, and they, however, feel that, you know, what they're doing is not responsible for creating these images. These images have existed and would exist whether or not they were doing pornography. They're not the ones authoring these images. They are, however, using those ideas around hypersexuality in order to survive in the economy, to turn sex into labor, and to negotiate porn. Because if the landscape is filled with these kind of expectations, then you have to find a way to work within those expectations. At the same time, you really also try to work against those expectations and transform them in the process. And that is what I took away from this project, is that these women were just not just, you know, acquiescing to these damaging stereotypes. They were negotiating them like they negotiate them in other parts of their lives outside of pornography, because these things are so powerful and rampant and part of every aspect of our lives, not just for sex workers, but for academics who were perceived as hypersexual too. And I'm talking about myself here. And the reason why I called it illicit eroticism is because what they're doing is seen to go against a Black women's respectable image. Respectability is something in the Black community that we've created as a counter to those damaging stereotypes. And so at the same time we're seen as being hypersexual in our own communities, there is a lot of pressure to conform to being normatively sexual, to being respectable, to not being hypersexual, to not drawing attention to yourself, to not being queer, to not being out there with your sexuality, to not use your sexuality as income, to really just be a good girl. And so I see that these women are defying both of these kind of very powerful forces. And the illicit part is that they are kind of doing this underground work engaging their eroticism and their sexual economy in a way that makes sense to them, and to make themselves be able to survive capitalism by having work, to allow themselves to appear sometimes in stereotypical images in order to make an income. And sometimes they do things like leave the set, say, I don't want to take this anymore. This is bothersome to me. Or sometimes they do things like Angel Kelly, I mentioned earlier, change the character, force the director to add a different scene, to make the character more complex. Sometimes they do things like make their own porn, like the new wave of porn directors that we see, and Shine Louise Houston and Vanessa Blue and Diana DeVoe and Nina Joyner. And so I think that what I'm trying to do in this book is call attention to the very ways in which Black women are very knowledgeable and savvy and critical of this entire terrain, this political economy, the social discourses and they're embedded in, and that they're very intelligent and political actors, and which I don't think that they're given credit for. I think they're just seen as being these very, you know, abused victims who have no agency and no control and no voice and no critique.
And this is why I think your book is so important, because I feel like we have had a lot of great Black feminist thinking and thought and work on stereotyping and poor representations of Black women and all of these different ways that Black women's sexuality is constrained. But we haven't had the next conversation after that, which is, where's the pushback? Where's the revolution? Like, where is the change going to happen? Right. I feel like I feel like a lot of academic work among certain Black feminist scholars sort of stays in the place of, this is all pretty much shitty. Okay. not in a technical term,
which is absolutely valuable, because nobody before them was pointing this shit out.
Right.
And so we actually need to sustain a conversation about how, you know, shitty these things are and how they have very real effects on people's lives. At the same time that, you know, those moments where Black women, scholars and critics and writers have, tried to open up thinking about the erotic, they've often been very critical of pornography. Black women, like Audre Lorde and Alice Walker and Patricia Hill Collins, they were very much aligned with the anti-porn feminist movement. Particularly in the 70s, many Black women, writers who commented on pornography were affiliated with the Take Back the Night campaign and the radical feminist movement against pornography. And we've seen that kind of alliance continue. So it was very difficult for me, actually, you know, bringing this up, you know, to navigate through a Black feminist scholarship and as, you know, a scholar in the academy who has to engage with, you know, established Black women professors, you know, taking this kind of approach where I'm not, you know, making an anti-porn argument. I think it's hard, you know, as a feminist period, but especially as a Black feminist. At the same time, I think that I'm starting to get my message heard. I actually got an email from Patricia Hill Collins that she read my book and reviewed it and thought it was very good.
Wow. Oh my God, that's big news.
That was really big, because she's like, in her famous book, Black Feminist Thought, you know, she has a passage on pornography. It's one of the few real, you know, focused discussions by a Black feminist writer on pornography, where it's, you know, it's just all about, you know, the Black women's degradation and it's, you know, it being one of the worst examples of sexualized racism or racialized sexism, however you want to have it. And so I think that I was very grateful for that. And maybe it's making an impact. I mean, I think that when I go around talking about the book to, you know, I've been to many universities now and talking to undergrads and graduate students who are reading it in their classes, which is just great. You know, they're thinking in ways that are even more, you know, challenging and progressive than what I was been trying to do for the past 15 years. So I'm super excited and think that the field and the conversation is moving forward. Part of that is because that there's been just this really new turn to engage explicit sexuality and queerness and trans identities and, you know, just very counter-normative politics within Black studies and Black feminism and the feminist movement more broadly. At the same time, I am, you know, worried that the mainstream of feminism is still very much allied with the anti-porn movement. And that has really been coming to a head. I just wrote an op-ed, Tristan, that came out in the Washington Post last week on the movement in Utah to declare porn a public health crisis. And that whole legislation by Senator Todd Wheeler was really, you know, basically authored and mobilized by anti-porn feminist critics like Gail Dines, who are now pushing this public health crisis question and are lobbying groups like the CDC and the UN and even, you know, European legislature. She had personal meetings with the Prime Minister of Iceland. She's met with many people in Sweden who, as you know, have this Nordic model to criminalize the buyers of prostitution, which is a huge mess. And so we're at this kind of worrisome moment where I think that this work is becoming more, you know, meaningful and political and controversial by the minute.
Okay, that's a really good point, but we've got to take another break. We're going to pick that up right afterwards, so don't go anywhere. More Sex Out Loud when we return. Hey everyone, it's Tristan. Listen, there is nothing sexier than experience. Just ask the Pleasure Chest. As the oldest sex-positive boutique in America, this legendary establishment has made it their mission to provide sexual fulfillment to everyone, regardless of orientation, identity, or experience. With stores in New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago, as well as online, the Pleasure Chest wants to help you have the best sex of your life. Whether you're buying your first vibrator or your 10th leather flogger, you'll be assisted by a knowledgeable and friendly staff in an elegant, sex-positive environment. If you're looking to expand your sexual expertise, they offer free weekly workshops in locations nationwide where no subject is taboo or off-limits. Visit PleasureChest.com to learn more, because sex never goes out of style. You can use the coupon code Tristan at checkout and enjoy a free Pleasure Chest lube with every purchase.
Hi, everyone. It's Tristan. In a loving relationship, a pleasure shared is a pleasure doubled. Lilo, the world's leading pleasure brand, has a gorgeous selection of luxury pleasure products for couples, each one perfectly designed to ensure both partners get the most from sex. Lilo's remote-controlled pleasure products feature an exclusive technology called Sense Motion. You can control the vibrations of the massager by simply tilting and moving the remote. It's incredibly intimate, even from a distance. All Lilo's luxury couples toys are waterproof, rechargeable, quiet, and absolutely beautiful. Try the best-selling Tiani 24K for the most sensuous shared pleasure you've ever experienced, or the Lilo Smart Wand for the most powerful all-over body massage of your life. Go to Lilo.com or any good adult retailer now to see how Lilo can bring you closer together.
You're tuned in to Sex Out Loud with your host, Tristan Taramino. We want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment, please send an email to Tristan@puckerup.com. That's Tristan@puckerup.com. Now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I've been talking today with Dr. Mireille Miller-Young about her book, A Taste for Brown Sugar, Black Women in Pornography. I wanted to encourage everyone to go look at Mireille's op-ed in the Washington Post. The Washington Post ran a series of op-eds about pornography, and in all their infinite wisdom, they included one nuanced, well-cited article by a pro-porn feminist, Mireille, and seven rapidly anti-porn pieces, some of which are based on complete junk science and sort of mass hysteria. So Washington Post, that was not what we call sort of fair and balanced journalism. Just want to call you out for that. And Violet Blue did a nice takedown of that. So if you also just Google Violet Blue, Washington Post, porn, you'll see her fantastic blog post about that. So we were talking about progress before the break. And in the book, you actually quote Paul Fishbein, who is the former editor of Adult Video News, and Susie Bright, who were writing in the 1990s a pretty honest piece about racism and racist representation and a general lack of investment in Black porn and performers. And as I was reading your book, just like a year ago, this Tracy Clark Flory piece came out online titled Porn's Race Problem. And to be quite frank, I mean, I love Tracy Clark Flory and the reporting was strong, but it sort of felt like an exact rehash of the 1990s article, which made me think, like, we haven't actually moved the needle very far within the industry. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel that the problems that were laid out, actually, and those, the Fishbein and the Bright articles were from the 80s.
Oh, the 80s. Okay.
And that was, you know, when they were observing, you know, the real rise of this, you know, genres of interracial and all Black porn, and the problems with, you know, the videos just being such poor quality, the stereotypical nature, you know, how you have talented actors that weren't given an opportunity to really do much with their role, you know, and really silly writing and things like this that were just racist. And it just continues. And I think that, you know, we just hadn't had anyone kind of giving voice to it from, you know, in terms of industry critics and academics for a while to draw attention to this. But it's certainly still an issue. And I think that, you know, according to my research, you know, which was from between 2002 to really like 2013, I found that Black women were paid half of what white women were paid. And the thing is that in addition to all the kinds of ways in which they're already in this degraded kind of, you know, genre of the industry, this low budget porn film, they experienced a great deal of kind of microaggressions, as well as like structural marginalization, lack of opportunity. And that since I was kind of wrapping up the research, the porn industry did this whole change where the economic bottom fell out in the country, which really affected porn, and the technological transformation to online, and particularly to the pirating through tube sites, took away so much wealth and economy from the porn industry that it actually made it such that I feel like in some aspects of my analysis are really almost unable to keep up with that vast change because I was finishing my research at the time that this was happening. And there's even fewer opportunities now for everybody, but especially for the marginalized populations in the business. And I just think that the problems that I've laid out that actually, you know, like I said, start in the 20s, really have just gotten more acute. And what we see now in the kind of gig economy of porn, where people can't just be porn stars anymore, they have to do a million other kinds of sex work or street work to even survive. That they're just in this kind of fight to even make ends meet, and this fight to actually make pornography that people are going to buy, you know, really they're at the bottom of the hierarchy and being able to kind of access and leverage any kind of power. And so it's not a happy story. What I think is most interesting within that is that I identify throughout these moments of critique and resilience by these multiply marginalized sex workers and their insights into what's happening. Because again, I don't think that they're given kind of credit for having a political critique, for having insight into how political economy works, for being savvy workers and creators and artists, and actually, you know, people who are very resilient and who are very important in taking care of their families and networks and communities. And so it's, I guess, long story short, I'm worried about the state of things right now in the industry for people. And I think that we're all hanging on to see what the proposition for condom only legislation in California that is going to be on the ballot in November is going to do to the industry, which may even, you know, harm it further.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mireille, thanks so much for spending a little time with us. And I will tell everyone about your book. And I highly recommend this book. It's a great book for everyone, non-academics and academics alike. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. I enjoyed the conversation. And thanks for featuring my book.
I want to close with one of my favorite quotes from the book. So we end on a moment of hope. This is Mireille writing, "The new wave of erotica texts produced by Black women are not simply positive representations that upset a large and enduring archive of negative representations, because they are not solely in the service of a racial progress narrative or the overflow of patriarchy or pornography. These are muddy, ambivalent explorations into unknown territory where power is a toy and sex may be a practice of freedom for a moment, even if it is for sale." So Mireille Miller-Young is the author of A Taste for Brown Sugar, Black Women, Sex Work, and Pornography, published by Duke University Press. You can follow her on Facebook and Twitter at Dr. Mireille. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Executive producer Karen Dana, associate producer Raymond Johnson, segment producer and editor Colton, announcer Cooper Beckett from Life on the Swing Set, Matt, my engineer, everyone at Voice America. If you want to listen to this show again or send it to someone you think will enjoy it, you can go to voiceamerica.com, search for Sex Out Loud, and listen to it on demand. You can also subscribe to it as a podcast on iTunes. Tune in next Friday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, same time, for another edition of the show. Until then, you can find me posting funny pictures on Instagram at Tristan Taramino, on Twitter at Tristan Taramino. The show on Twitter is at Sex Out Loud Radio. And take some time on this National Donut Day to both have a donut and talk about sex out loud.
That's a wrap on today's show. Go to voiceamerica.com to listen to this and other episodes on demand or as podcasts. And make sure you come back next Friday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, for Sex Out Loud with Tristan Taramino on Voice America Variety.